evening. I am Alan Gervey, and this is Gervey's Law. So I am back in studio live. Last couple of weeks, I was away on vacation, and I'll tell you something. It's so great when you tape a show in advance, and this is not taped, this is live, because when you tape the show, you know you have it in the can, and you can go away and enjoy vacation and not worry about it. Today, well, you know, we have a special guest, but unfortunately we haven't been able to get a hold of him yet. So that's what happens when you are live, and I'm just still looking for some sort of signal that we have him on the phone because he is in Washington, but it doesn't look like it so far. In fact, I just heard in my ear, not yet, and I will tell you, that's what I heard for the last 2 weeks when I kept saying to my wife, can we enjoy our vacation? And she said, not yet, not yet. We got to make sure the kids get off to camp. And yeah, they did go to sleepaway camp for the first time at sleepaway camp, 8 and 9 years old. And I'll tell you, I'm not sure what they learned from sleepaway camp other than there was a kid dancing around singing California Girls by Katy Perry while wearing no clothes. I think that's being naked. So there he was, naked, running around, singing California Girls. And that's what their takeaway was from going to summer camp. So for all of you folks out there who have kids who you want to send to camp, that's what you can expect. And this camp was in Canada. In a wilderness camp, my son Hudson begged me to send him to a sports camp where he could play basketball and baseball and hockey all day long. But no, we sent them to a wilderness camp where they basically did nothing but sit in the wilderness trying to make a fire. I'm not sure they even canoed, even though they wanted to. But I'll tell you something. It was a special experience. It was probably better than any sports camp because they learned what it was like to live with other kids who were from all different walks of life. There were the nerds. There were the kooks. There were the brainiacs. There were the jocks. They were all put together in a cabin, 9-year-olds and 8-year-olds. And they had to live together. And it was funny because the first time we saw some pictures of them at camp, we looked and we said, whose clothes are they wearing? They had changed clothes. They weren't wearing their own clothes. It was really weird. We couldn't even figure out which kid was ours because we didn't recognize any of the clothes. It was kind of like Lord of the Flies, I think. You know, these kids were fending for themselves. And afterwards, we asked Hudson and Harper, we said, what was going on there? Why were the kids fighting and why were they doing all the stuff? And where were the counselors? And they said, well, they were on their phones. Of course they were on their phones. They were texting. They were doing things. And I really didn't have a problem with that. Nancy wasn't thrilled about it, but I didn't have a problem with it because I think it forced our kids to deal with the other kids. Like in Lord of the Flies, they had to figure out, you know, who was going to have the conch and how they were going to get along. And I think it was great for our kids. It was a great education. Who cares about counselors? So what? Counselors will tell them what to do? No, our kids weren't told what to do. They were actually learning on their own how to deal with other kids, how to make friends, how to team up with other kids to control other kids. In fact, there was one kid in Hudson's cabin who at 9 years old was playing the role of therapist. He took the kid aside who was dancing naked to California Girls and had a long conversation with him, a 30-minute therapy session. This is a 9-year-old with a 9-year-old explaining to him why certain behavior wasn't appropriate and why other behavior would be more acceptable and how kids make friends and how kids make enemies and how to get along with other kids. And that is what it is camp is all about. Who cares? Anyone? I mean, my son was playing baseball. He's back today playing baseball in a tournament. You can do that anywhere. You can do that at community centers. But I'll tell you something. What you can't learn is how to live with other kids. You just can't do that unless you are stuck on an island. And this place was an island. You should have seen the pictures of my kids as they were pushed off onto this boat to go to this island in a foreign country in Canada, not knowing a soul. And it was raining out to boot. And there they are with these long faces saying, "Mom, Dad, what the heck are you doing? Why are you sending us to this camp?" And my answer was simple. We needed to get rid of you. We needed to get you on an island, put you far away so we could have some peace and quiet. And you could learn how to get along with other kids, even if it meant throwing pillows at them and peeing on them from the top. Some kid peed on from the top bunk to the bottom bunk. Fortunately, it wasn't my kid, and my kid wasn't the recipient of it either. So, you know, that was fine. I think the girls actually got along better. The boys, it sounded like it was chaos. With my daughter Harper, she made some great friends, and they seemed to get along really well in their cabin. So maybe there's a difference between a 9-year-old boy's cabin and an 8-year-old girl's cabin. I don't know. But it seems like, you know, when she came back afterward, she was like, "I want to go back. I want to hang out with those girls some more." My son, he was like, "Oh my goodness gracious, some boys are just obnoxious." I'm not going to name any names. I'm trying to figure out whether we have a guest or not. Do we have a thumbs up or a thumbs down? Down, thumbs down. That means no guest. So the last couple of weeks, as I said, the shows were taped. We had Alan Dershowitz and Robert O'Brien. And that's why you tape shows, because if you have situations like this, you don't have to listen to me telling you about the experiences of my kids at sleepaway camp. By the way, we also went to Banff and Lake Louise after camp, and it was really pretty impressive to see how beautiful the world can be. And the clean air, the beautiful mountains, people in good moods. Here in LA, people aren't always in good moods. So I was just happy to be able to be amongst other people who were actually in good moods. Lake Louise, Banff. We went to a place called Emerald Lake, Moraine Lake. Beautiful, beautiful, clean air. The environment was incredible, and it was just nice to be away, and I hope everyone enjoyed the last 2 weeks that were taped. I'm telling you again, so whatever Alan Dershowitz said and whatever Robert O'Brien said, we could edit that, but we can't edit Jamie Raskin because he's going to be live, and, you know, Dershowitz probably needed some editing. O'Brien was the perfect diplomat. Let's see what we get from Jamie Raskin. I'm going to take a quick break, and I'm going to give him a proper introduction because we only have 1 minute, and I'll tell you with everything that has gone on over the last couple of years and the book that he has written and the lives that he has touched, he really needs to have a proper introduction. So we have Congressman Jamie Raskin on the line, live from Washington. I'm back. I'm not in the mountains of the Canadian Rockies anymore. And we're going to talk to Jamie after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, there was a time I didn't like the love, I liked the climbers. There was no sister then. It's running out of time and one-liners. And I was afraid.
All right, we are back. A little Dar Williams for you. I think that'll be meaningful to U.S. Representative of Maryland's 8th Congressional District. And like I said before the break, he's going to get a proper introduction. And I think the most proper introduction is probably to say he's a real mensch, the meaning of mensch, a decent person. He's provocative and he's a humanitarian and he's done so much important work for this country. He is really providing people with what they need to hear and read at this difficult time in our history. And I'm going to talk about his book in a minute. But like I said, 8th Congressional District in Maryland, that's an affluent suburban county northwest of Washington, D.C. He's held the position since 2017. He served before that as Maryland State Senate from 2000, senators from 2007 to 2016. He's the chair of the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, member of the House Judiciary Committee and the House Committee on Rules, amongst other committees that he is part of. He was the lead impeachment manager for the second impeachment of President Donald Trump in response to the attack on the U.S. Capitol. He was a constitutional law professor at American University, Washington College of Law, for more than 25 years. And there he co-founded and directed the LLM program, the master's program in law and government, and co-founded the Marshall Brennan Constitutional Literacy Project. He's written several books and scholarly articles. He tweets at Rep. Raskin. He's been a relentless champion for environmental protection. And his most recent book, which is a New York Times bestseller, very, very well reviewed, called Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy, is a must read to understand the human condition, for better or for worse, the overwhelming importance of preserving democracy, and one of the finest human beings that ever walked the face of this earth, his son Tommy. Representative Raskin, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show, and thanks for having me tonight. I'm psyched.
I'm glad to have you. And, you know, I have to tell you, wow, what you've been through over the last couple years, what you've endured, as your book is titled, Unthinkable, the trauma that you've been through, not only personally, but through your position representing your constituency and the country as a whole, has been nothing short of unbelievable. The strength and the courage and the resilience that you have shown with the loss of your son by suicide and the impact of the country with the insurrection, and how this has impacted you as a human being. How have you found this resilience, Jamie, to keep going on and to be such a leader in this country?
Well, look, thank you for those excessively kind words. You know, I have felt from the beginning like Tommy is in my chest, he's in my heart. And Sarah and I have two daughters, and we have tons of nieces and nephews, and I feel very connected to Tommy's generation and his friends, and I feel very connected to the things he believed in and his ideals and dreams for the world. And so that's been a critical part of it. And I've got wonderful colleagues and friends, and you know, we have a country to fight for and a democracy to be strengthening and improving, and a union to be making more perfect. And you know, I took an oath to do that, and that's my job. And you know, I've had some hard times, as you say, but we're coming through them. And the January 6th committee has been giving me a lot of hope, you know, to have a truly bipartisan committee with people working from both big parties together to tell the truth to the American people, and us penetrating the sound barrier and actually moving public opinion and waking people up to that really old-fashioned thing called facts, like things that actually happened, real history. So that's coming alive for people, and I feel good about that. You don't have democracy without truth, and we're working to get both of them back.
I didn't really know that there was anything called facts anymore. I thought it was interpretation. When you talk about facts, how do you separate some skewed interpretations from facts. And as a lawyer, I will tell you, I am always very sensitive to what is truth with a big T, and truth may be stretched a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the best that we can do in democracy and certainly in courts is not truth with a big T. I mean, that's what you get in totalitarian societies with a big T and authoritarian societies. What you get in democracy is truths with a small T, and that comes through testimony, people swearing an oath to tell the truth and then getting up and doing it and subjecting themselves to questioning and so on. And one of the remarkable things here is that the vast majority of people have cooperated with this and come in and testified. And you have people like Cassidy Hutchinson, you know, young people in their 20s or 30s who are brave enough to swear an oath before the country and go and tell the truth. And then, of course, you've got a bunch of old right wingers who are willing to send other people into battle against police officers and to smash windows and to try to topple the government, but they won't be there to fight themselves, and they won't even come out and testify about what they did. And so, you know, they deserve nothing but shame from the country.
You mentioned Cassidy Hutchinson. Why was she a credible witness?
Well, she was a totally credible witness because she's got a very good memory. She had no incentive to lie, no motive to lie. She spoke against interest in a way because she's been a lifelong Republican, has been working for, you know, President Trump and Mark Meadows and the Republicans in Congress. And that's where her politics are and that's where her ideas are. But she was not willing to lie about what happened. And she was able to quote very specific things that Donald Trump said, like, let them in. You know, he didn't care whether or not they were armed. These are my people, and they're not here to hurt me. And she talked about him, you know, flinging his hamburger and French fries and ketchup plate all over the walls. And so, you know, we get that indelible image of ketchup on the walls of the White House and then blood on the walls of the Capitol because of his rage against democracy and his refusal to accept the fact that he lost the election by more than 7 million votes, 306 to 232 in the Electoral College, the same margin that Hillary lost to him by in 2016, which he called a landslide.
You know, I have to tell you, in listening to this, it harkens back on being in court so many times and trying to figure out what the witness is saying, whether there's some credibility to it or not. And I know you've heard a lot of testimony that you have seen is not credible. And it was interesting because I was reading somewhere where after some lengthy testimony that you found to be just incredible, incredulous, not worthy of a lot of time, you did what I do on a lot of trials. You sit there and you want to cross-examine the person. You want to talk to the witness about what they're saying, but you feel maybe that's wasted energy, and maybe it's best, it's more powerful if you just leave it alone. And I know you invoked the Tommy rule, I'm going to call it, which is thinking of your son and how he would do things and just say no questions or let the witness go. How do you do that when you have such a kind of burning desire to show someone's an idiot?
Well, you got to remember that ultimately it's not our goal to show anyone to be an idiot. It's our goal to defend democratic institutions and keep democracy moving forward. You know, we got millions of disenfranchised people in America. We need statehood for Washington, D.C. We need statehood for Puerto Rico. We need a constitutional amendment on the right to vote. And, you know, the Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Jim Jordan people would really love nothing more than for us to descend to their level of polemic and invective and just get in the mud with them, because it keeps us from moving forward. You know, so I guess, you know, I mean, if it doesn't take too much time, you can hit back at them. It can be, you know, psychically satisfying for a moment. But fundamentally, we've got much bigger things to do than that.
How did Tommy see the big picture? Because you talked about how, you know, in this piece, by the way, which is incredible, the statement of Congressman Jamie Raskin and Sarah Bloom Raskin, your wife, on the remarkable life of Tommy Raskin, which was written about 5 days after he passed away. And it's a great read for anyone who wants to learn a little more about Tommy and the Raskins. Really tells a lot. But he seemed to have such intuitive ways of dealing with people. And I know you have kind of invoked that when you're in these proceedings, thinking, you know, what would Tommy do? And when you think of a 25-year-old or, you know, obviously before that, 18, 19, 20, Harvard Law School student, how was he so precocious and so wise to know, for instance, when some of us who have been doing this gig for a long time as a lawyer want to fight back, but he knew how to keep the peace and how to keep the focus?
Well, that's kind of you to say that about Tommy. I mean, he was precociously wise and compassionate for all living beings, regardless of politics, and for all species. He was a passionate vegan. But there's an interesting exchange between Tommy and Dinesh D'Souza, which you can find online, when Tommy was just in his freshman year of college. It's either the spring semester of his freshman year or fall of his sophomore year, but Dinesh D'Souza came to campus, and Tommy asked him some really thoughtful, substantive, probing questions about what he had just said. And Dinesh D'Souza was so threatened and overwhelmed, he immediately just descended into the gutter and began attacking Tommy and raising completely extraneous, irrelevant issues. And what's amazing to people when they watch it is to see a young man stay on the high road and maintain his composure. D'Souza started asking him all kinds of personal questions, like, well, what do you do to help other people? And Tommy kind of looks around and says, well, I don't know if this is of any interest to anybody, but he starts talking about, you know, the tutoring that he did in high school and in college and so on. And there's something just wonderfully humane about Tommy's response in the face of just utterly juvenile and authoritarian type tactics of debate.
Yeah. Isn't that truly representative, though, of what this country is facing when you talk about juvenile responses and, you know, you're getting away from the truth that you just talked about, because people, you know, and I don't want to use a cliche, but maybe can't handle the truth, and they have their political perspectives so entrenched in their being that they're not willing to listen, where Tommy was trying to redirect D'Souza or any other detractor.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's also reflective of a kind of cultish way of thinking. I mean, you know, if you're a Donald Trump true believer at this point, you have to swallow absolute absurdities, like Donald Trump won the election, even though more than 60 federal and state courts, including 8 judges nominated the bench by Trump himself, rejected every single claim of electoral fraud and corruption affecting the outcome. And then you have to accept the absurdity that, you know, January 6th was the real election, that the mob confronted the police with hugs and kisses and all that. And so what happens in a cult is that in order to deal with the cognitive dissonance of just spouting disinformation and lies all day, you end up having to demonize people who just try to speak the truth.
Right.
And call them names and insults. And then, you know, it's like Roger Stone getting up in the portions that we clipped at the hearings and saying, this is a struggle between good and evil. This is a struggle between light and darkness and so on. And you're almost tempted to just say, you know what, you're right, Roger Stone. And of course, you're speaking for the forces of darkness. But it's that kind of binary extreme thinking that characterizes people who are in a cult environment. And they are.
Yeah, and we got to take a quick break, but we're going to return and try to avoid the hyperbole and rhetoric and get just to the heart of these issues. We're talking to Congressman Jamie Raskin. We have two more segments with Jamie. We got a lot to talk about. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. All right, we're back. We are speaking with Congressman Jamie Raskin. The book is called Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy by Jamie Raskin. One of his constituents wrote about the book, "I love Jamie Raskin. He's my representative, and even before the 1-6 debacle, he handed out pocket constitutions at parades. While not the most delicious of parade treats, a far more useful giveaway, the book is an ode to the spirit of Tommy and the hope for the future of America. Highly recommend the audiobook as Jamie reads it. He brought me to tears, and I've never had an audiobook do that." Well, congratulations, Jamie, for bringing this woman to tears in a good way, because obviously she saw this book as hope for the future of America. As we all watch the U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack, how can the book show this kind of hopefulness, promise, and positivity for this country?
Well, I quote my father, who Tommy was very close to, and my dad used to say, when everything looks hopeless, you're the hope. So we grew up with that sense of, I guess you could say, guilt or responsibility.
I think that's called Jewish guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was all in my house, too. That's the, I mean, you know, it's so important to understand that it's not about us, but it's about others.
So, you know, I find that the young generation of people, the young people who are in my Democracy Summer Project across the country, including in California, are a wonderful generation, and they've been burdened with a lot, like climate change and gun violence and COVID-19 and so on. But they, their minds are free of a lot of the stuff that older generations grew up with, like the racism and the sexism and the anti-Semitism and the immigrant bashing and so on. And they're free of all of that. They're also a little bit beyond grammar too, but that's a different problem. But basically it's a wonderful generation, and they give me a lot of hope, and we've got a responsibility to engage with them and to help turn them into political organizers and leaders who will be able to confront the immense problems of civilization that they're inheriting. We don't really have a lot of time to defeat right-wing authoritarianism and fascism and deal with the gun violence problem and so on, because climate change is bearing down on us and the whole world, and we've got to get beyond all of the nonsense as they try to drag us back to the 20th century and, you know, relitigate the fight over fascism. I'm sorry, that's over, and we need to solidify democracy and keep moving forward.
You know, it's a very different perspective that Alan Dershowitz gave us 2 weeks ago on the show when he talked about the youth and said that he fears for the future because of what the kids are learning, and I'm calling them kids, students at schools. And you're taking a much more positive perspective. Tell us about the Democracy Summer Project and why it is something hopeful for the youth versus something negative that he spoke about, mainly about anti-Semitism and some of the other causes that he felt was out of control on college campuses.
Yeah, well, if you meet real young people and you listen to them and don't just chatter at them, you will find that this is an enormously engaged and soulful and serious generation of young people who feel all of the problems of our society and our world and want to work on them. And they've been somewhat disconnected from the struggles of the past. And so the Democracy Summer basically connects them to the civilizing movements of our time the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the human rights movement, the peace movement, the LGBTQ movement, and says to them, you are the heirs to this extraordinary legacy of people who have fought for a more perfect union. And we need to keep moving forward. We need to keep expanding and strengthening democracy. And we need to unify as much as we can to confront climate change. Otherwise, we're going to be one of the thousands of species that go extinct every year, in our ecosystem. It's a very serious issue. So, I would view Alan Dershowitz was my criminal law professor, and I don't like to speak ill of my professors, but, I view him as basically engaging in a form of ideological extremism and political correctness, and he's just like the politically correct people that he denounces. He's got a very narrow ideological view. And look, the point of politics is what we can be doing to actually make life better for people, not getting up and trying to score points.
But don't you think it's also a generational thing? Not to say anything about Alan's generation, but you're from an earlier generation and you're in contact through your three kids who, Tommy first and your two daughters. Aren't you more in touch with what's really going on than someone who may have, that ship sailed some time ago?
Well, I think it's a struggle for all of us to stay in touch. And I hope to be getting some grandchildren someday soon. And I'm in touch with like all of my nieces and nephews and grandnieces and grandnephews and all that kind of stuff. But it's been a very tough time for young people.
Yeah.
And we have a national emotional and mental health crisis, according to the Surgeon General. We've got this terrible opioid crisis, and mine is not the only family to be devastated by suicide. And so there's a lot that is on the minds of young people, and I don't want to put all the burden on them. We have a responsibility to work with them to get through this very tough period. I mean, certainly when I was growing up, and I imagine it's the same for you, you never imagined that there would be violent insurrections and attempts at political coups by presidents who refuse to accept the results of elections. I mean, the political scientists tell us that the two hallmarks of a fascist political party are, one, they don't accept the results of democratic elections if they don't favor them, and two, they embrace or they tolerate political violence that will work to advance their objectives. Well, we have a major political party that is very much headed in that direction, which means that we have one political party, the Democratic Party, which is the party of democracy today, with all of our flaws and imperfections.
And I want to follow up on that. But before I do, you did mention that other people have been struck with the tragedy of suicide. My best friend growing up in Canada lost his 22-year-old son by suicide. And this was an extremely, extremely high IQ'd boy who I knew my whole life, a brilliant kid who worked at Google at 20. He finished high school at 16, college at 18, the sweetest, most aware person, thinking of others all of the time. And people don't realize that these special people can succumb to something as devastating as depression and suicide. Now, my friend has started a foundation for past few years called Buddy Check for Jesse, which involves hockey, and they're helping coaches support mental health in dressing rooms and outside of the dressing rooms, and building awareness for the youth to understand how to deal with challenges, with mental health challenges. And they have green tape on hockey sticks, which green being the color of mental health, and it's expanded to other sports so that the youth of today can understand that it's okay to check on your buddies and to talk about mental health. Has that been something that you've learned over the years dealing with these issues and understanding how the youth can have to, in these difficult, difficult times, especially with social media, COVID, and everything else, have to face mental challenges?
Right. Well, I mean, everybody is on an individual psychological and emotional journey, and, you know, different young people are dealing with different kinds of symptoms. I mean, it's certainly the stigma has faded away as a majority of young people report depression or anxiety or other kinds of mental health symptoms. But although we're on an individual journey, it all exists in a social context. And if people are surrounded, young people are surrounded by grown-up politicians who tell lies and engage and practice disinformation and propaganda, polarization, demonization, scapegoating, stereotyping, ethnic baiting, all that kind of stuff, that creates a very hostile, corrosive social environment. You don't want to attribute particular problems that individuals are having to the social climate. But on the other hand, you know, all of us inhabit a social climate. So we've got a responsibility to try to improve it, because it's very ugly what's been created. And the dangerous extremists on social media have exacerbated everybody's problems.
Yeah, you can say that again. And by the way, you tweeted that the suicide prevention number now, 988, is out there to help anyone who has needs some help or wants to talk to someone. That's 988. We got to take a quick break. We're talking to Congressman Jamie Raskin. This is Gervie's Law, and we will be right back.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
All right, we're back. We're talking to Congressman Jamie Raskin, member of the U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack. Now, Congressman Raskin, a lot of people believe that the committee has done an excellent job in laying out what happened and looking at the facts. The question on, I think, everyone's mind is, what happens now? Maybe people aren't as confident that anything will come of this, even though there has been so much time, money, and energy spent on trying to get to the truth. What do you say
to
that?
Well, there are questions of individual accountability, and there are questions of social and political accountability. And on the individual side, that really is up to the Department of Justice at the federal level, and also the Georgia prosecutor, who seems very engaged and up to the task of taking on Trump's plot to try to commit election fraud down there and get Secretary of State Raffensperger just to find him 11,780 votes. We pass the ball over to their court. That's really up to them. I mean, one of the traditions Donald Trump destroyed was of the political branches respecting the independence of the law enforcement function. And I would like to try to, you know, abide by that as much as possible. Now, on the social and political accountability point, I mean, we haven't totally gotten there yet on our committee, but we're going to adopt a whole sweeping set of recommendations, I hope, to address everything from the weaknesses in the Electoral Count Act that would allow, you know, the Trump's forces to try and do this, to the question of extremist militias who claim the title of militia when they have no right to do that. The 50 states ban the existence of private armed militias, and I think that we should do that at the federal level as well. To probably the most fundamental question, which is the guarantee of voting rights to the people and securing our elections against efforts by GOP legislatures and governors under Donald Trump's spell to revise popular vote totals and just declare victors or deform the process. I mean, the electoral democracy depends on guaranteeing people's right to vote against voter suppression and then honestly counting their ballots and allowing those results to determine the victor.
When you talk about what the DOJ might do with the information, looking at your book, Unthinkable, you reference Nancy Pelosi, her quoting Abraham Lincoln about public sentiment being everything. Tell us what you believe public sentiment will mean when the DOJ, or if the Supreme Court at a certain point is brought into these issues.
Well, I think there's been a kind of low-level ideological presumption that the Department of Justice and prosecutors try to avoid prosecuting former presidents or former officials because, you know, that somehow is reflective of what goes on in a banana republic. Even if there's real crime committed, you know, even if you've got somebody like Senator McConnell who's saying Donald Trump is singularly, factually, ethically, morally responsible, but I'm not going to vote to convict him in the Senate because we don't actually have jurisdiction over the case, which was ridiculous and which flew in the face of more than two centuries of precedent in which we dealt with on the first day of trial. But nonetheless, he made that speech and he basically said, Trump can be tried. You can go after him criminally and civilly. But even with all that, there's this kind of presumption that you don't want to do it. I think that presumption has clearly shifted or dissipated in the face of the overwhelming and unrefuted, if not irrefutable, evidence that we have seen in these hearings and that we have collected from more than 1,000 witnesses and tens of thousands of documents. And so I think the ground has shifted under the Department of Justice. I mean, the charging criteria that DOJ uses for whether or not to bring a case where you've got probable cause, and certainly there's probable cause of all kinds of offenses here, are three. One, the culpability of the defendant, which to me is just overwhelming. Donald Trump's about the guiltiest person on the planet at this point. Two, the gravity of the offense. And again, it's hard to think of a graver offense of a political nature in a democracy than trying to overthrow an election. And then three, deterrence of future misconduct,
right? Right.
Specific deterrence of this person, but also general deterrence of other people who will take it that this is a normal way of doing business.
Now, putting on your constitutional law professor hat for a moment, Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of Berkeley Law, has said on this program that clearly the Constitution permits the what you have said, that the president can be tried and can be found guilty for these transgressions. Why are there still people saying that the president is untouchable under the DOJ when some of the most prolific constitutional law professors are really clearing the way for the DOJ to do something?
Well, they might just be making the realpolitik assessment that Donald Trump for decades now has operated like a mob boss, and he writes little down. He communicates just through words and winks and nods, and he usually creates, you know, barriers of several people between him and the criminal conduct that he sets into motion. Now, we saw exceptions to that, like the phone call with Brad Raffensperger, which Raffensperger recorded because he was so alarmed by what Trump was doing. And we've seen some other incidents where he's been directly involved. But we are getting people now like Cassidy Hutchinson quoting him. She famously quoted him at one of the hearings saying, well, you know, let them in, referring to the armed protesters, let them into his speech on the Ellipse, because he said that, you know, these are my people. They're not here to hurt me. And he, you know, then wanted to, you know, point them like a missile at the Capitol and send them down over that way. So, yeah, I think they might just be saying he's going to be hard to get factually. Some of them, you know, may be saying that it could provoke something like a civil war if you were to prosecute Trump. But I think he's rapidly losing support. I don't think it's going to cause a civil war, and I think it will restore the notion that the rule of law is for everybody. And elected officials are not the masters of the people. We are the servants of the people. And the minute we think we are the masters of the people, that is the time to evict, eject, reject, impeach, convict, and start all over again.
So what is your hope as we close out here for the future with the committee and moving forward with this country?
I just want the America that lives in everybody's heart and everybody's mind to come back again. We are not a racist country. We are not an anti-Semitic country. We are not a misogynistic country that greets women by grabbing their genitals. We're not a country that engages with dangerous extremist groups and ideas and that lives on hate. That's not who we are. So I just want to get real America back and then keep democracy moving, because Tocqueville said in Democracy in America that voting rights and democracy in our country are either shrinking and subsiding or they're expanding and growing. And we've got to get back on the growth track.
And that's how democracy is preserved. The book is called Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. One of the readers said this: Jamie Raskin may have just gone a long way toward restoring some of my faith in humanity. Exactly and desperately what I need coming out of 2022. Maybe she said that best. Faith in humanity, and I think that's what you're talking about when you say that this is not America and America is better than that. Jamie, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and taking your time to be on Gervie's Law, and good luck with the continuation of the committee and moving forward, bringing America together again.
The pleasure is all mine. Thanks for what you do. Hang tough.
All right, you too. Congressman Jamie Raskin. And that's going to do it for another edition of Gervie's Law. Coming up in the next few weeks, I think we have Randy Bachman. That'll be interesting for you music lovers. Montel Williams for you talk show people, and a host of other interesting guests from all walks of life, all trying to bring America together again. Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law. We will see you next week.